This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Faithful Place by Tana French. Read for you by Tim Gerard Reynolds. With an author's note read by John Curlis.
Prologue. In all your life, only a few moments matter. Mostly, you never get a good look at them except in hindsight, long after they've zipped past you. The moment when you decided whether to talk to that girl, slow down on that blind bend, stop and find that condom. I was lucky, I guess you could call it. I got to see one of mine, face to face, and recognize it for what it was. I got to feel the riptide pull of my life spinning around me, one winter night, while I waited in the dark at the top of Faithful Place. I was 19, old enough to take on the world and young enough to be a dozen kinds of stupid. And that night, as soon as both my brothers were snoring, I slid out of our bedroom with my rucksack on my back and my docs hanging from one hand. The floorboard creaked, and in the girls' room, one of my sisters murmured in her sleep. But I was magic that night, riding high on that surge tide, unstoppable. My parents didn't even turn over on the pull-out bed as I moved through the front room, close enough to touch. The fire had burned down to nothing but a muttering red glow. In the rucksack was everything important I owned. Jeans, T-shirts, second-hand wireless, £100 and my birth cert. That was all you needed to go over to England, back then. Rosie had the ferry tickets. I waited for her at the end of the road, in the shadows outside the foggy yellow circle of lamplight. The air was cold as glass, with a savoury burnt edge from the hops up at Guinness's. I had three pairs of socks under the docks, and I stuffed my hands deep into the pockets of my German army parka and listened one last time to my street, alive and moving down the long currents of the night. A woman laughing, "Ah, now who said you could?" A window slamming down. Scrabble of a rat along brickwork, a man coughing, the whoosh of a bike around the corner. The low, fierce grumble of mad Johnny Malone in the basement of number 14, talking himself to sleep. Couple noises somewhere. Muffled whimpers. Rhythmic bumps. And I thought about the smell of Rosie's neck, and grinned up at the sky. I heard the bells of the city chime for midnight. Christchurch, St. Pat's, St. Michin's, huge round notes tumbling down from the sky like a celebration, ringing in our own secret new year. When they rang one, I was afraid. A trail of faint rustles and thumps all down the back gardens, and I straightened up ready, but she didn't come climbing over the end wall. Probably someone sneaking home. Late and guilty, in at a window. In number 7, Sally Hearn's newest kid cried, a thin, defeated wail, till she dragged herself awake and sang to it. I know where I'm going. Painted rooms are bonny. When they rang 2, the mix-up hit me like a kick in the hole. It catapulted me right over the end wall into the garden of number 16, condemned since before I was born. Colonized by us kids ignoring the awful warnings, littered with beer cans and fag ends and lost virginities. I leaped up the rotten stairs 4 at a time, without caring who heard. I was so sure I could already see her, furious copper curls and fists on hips. Where the fuck have you been? Splintered floorboards, holes punched in plaster, debris and cold dark drafts, and no one. In the top front room I found the note, just a page ripped out of a kid's school copy. On the bare floor, fluttering in the pale rectangle of light from the window, it looked like it had been there for 100 years. That was when I felt that riptide change jackknife and turn deadly, much too strong to fight, and not on my side anymore. I didn't take the note with me. By the time I left number 16, I knew it by heart, and I had the rest of my life to try to believe it. I left it where it was, and went back to the end of the road. I waited there in the shadows, watching the plumes of smoke that my breath sent into the lamplight, while the bells tolled 3 and 4 and 5. The night faded to a thin, sad grey, and round the corner a milk cart clattered over cobblestones towards the dairy, and I was still waiting for Rosie Daly at the top of Faithful Place. Chapter 1. My father once told me that the most important thing every man should know is what he would die for.
"If you don't know that," he said, "what are you worth? Nothing. You're not a man at all."
I was 13, and he was 3/4 of a way into a bottle of Gordon's Finest, but hey, good talk. As far as I recall, he was willing to die A, for Ireland, B, for his mother, who had been dead for 10 years, and C, to get that bitch Maggie Thatcher. All the same, at any moment of my life since that day, I could have told you straight off the bat exactly what I would die for. At first it was easy. My family, my girl, my home. Later, for a while, things got more complicated. These days they hold steady, and I like that. It feels like something a man can be proud of. I would die for, in no particular order, my city, my job, and my kid. The kid is well behaved, so far. The city is Dublin, and the job is on the undercover squad, so it may sound obvious which one I'm most likely to wind up dying for, but it's been a while since work handed me anything scarier than a paperwork megaturd. The size of this country means a field agent's shelf life is short. 2 ops, maybe 4, and your risk of being spotted gets too high. I used up my 9 lives a long time back. I stay behind the scenes, for now, and run operations of my own. Here's the real risk in undercover. In the field and out. You create illusions for long enough, you start thinking you're in control. It's easy to slide into believing you're the hypnotist here, the mirage master, the smart cookie who knows what's real and how all the tricks are done. The fact is, you're still just another slack-jawed mark in the audience. No matter how good you are, this world is always going to be better at this game. It's more cunning than you are. It's faster. And it's a whole lot more ruthless. All you can do is try to keep up, know your weak spots, and never stop expecting the sucker punch. The second time my life geared up for the sucker punch, it was a Friday afternoon at the beginning of December. I'd spent the day doing maintenance work on some of my current Mirages. One of my boys, who would not be getting any cookies from Uncle Frank in his Christmas stocking, had got himself into a situation wherein, for complex reasons, he needed an elderly lady whom he could introduce to several low-level drug dealers as his granny, and I was heading over to my ex-wife's place to pick up my kid for the weekend. Olivia and Holly live in a jaw-droppingly tasteful semi-D on a manicured cul-de-sac in Dalkey. Olivia's daddy gave it to us for a wedding present. When we moved in, it had a name instead of a number.
I got rid of that fast, but still, I should have copped right then that this marriage was never going to work.
If my parents had known I was getting married, my ma would have gone deep into hock at the credit union, bought us a lovely floral living room suite, and been outraged if we took the plastic off the cushions. Olivia kept herself bang in the middle of the doorway in case I got ideas about coming in. "Holly's almost ready," she said. Olivia, and I say this hand on heart with the proper balance of smugness and regret, is a stunner. Tall, with a long, elegant face, plenty of soft, ash-blonde hair, and the kind of discreet curves you don't notice at first, and then can't stop noticing. That evening, she was smoothed into an expensive black dress and delicate tights, and her grandmother's diamond necklace that only comes out on big occasions, and the Pope himself would have whipped off his skullcap to mop his brow. Me, being a less classy guy than the Pope, I wolf-whistled.
Big date?
We're going for dinner.
Does we involve Dermo again?
Olivia's way too smart to let me yank her chain that easily.
His name's Dermot, and yes, it does.
I did, impressed.
That's 4 weekends running, am I right? Tell me something. Is tonight the big night?
Olivia called up the stairs.
Holly, your father's here.
While she had her back turned, I headed on past her into the hall. She was wearing Chanel number 5, same as she has ever since we met. Upstairs.
Daddy, I'm coming, I'm coming, I'm coming, I just have to...
And then a long, intense stream of chatter as Holly explained her complicated little head without caring whether anyone could hear her. I yelled,
"You take your time, sweetheart,"
on my way into the kitchen. Olivia followed me. "Dermot will be here any minute," she told me. I wasn't clear on whether this was a threat or a plea. I flipped open the fridge and had a look inside. I don't like the cut of that fella. He's got no chin. I never trust a man with no chin.
Well, fortunately, your taste in men isn't relevant here.
It is, if you're getting serious enough that he'll be spending time around Holly. What's his surname again?
Once, back when we were heading for the split, Olivia slammed the fridge door on my head.
I could tell she was thinking about doing it again. I stayed leaning over to give her every opportunity, but she kept her cool.
Why do you want to know?
I'll need to run him through the computer.
I pulled out a carton of orange juice and gave it a shake.
What's this crap? When did you stop buying the good stuff?
Olivia's mouth, subtle nude lipstick, was starting to tighten.
You will not run Dermot through any computer, Frank.
Got no choice, I told her cheerfully. I have to make sure he's not a kiddie fiddler, haven't I?
Sweet Lord, Frank, he is not.
Maybe not, I acknowledged. Probably not. But how can you be sure, Liv? Wouldn't you rather be safe than sorry? I uncapped the juice and took a swig.
Holly! Olivia called louder. Hurry up!
I can't find my horse!
A couple of thumps overhead. I told Olivia, they target single mammies with lovely little kids. And it's amazing how many of them don't have chins. Have you ever noticed that?
No, Frank, I haven't, and I won't have you using your job to intimidate.
Take a good look next time there's a pedo on the telly. White van and no chin, I guarantee you.
What does Dermo drive?
Holly!
I had another big gulp of juice, wiped off the spout with my sleeve, and stuck the carton back in the fridge.
That tastes like cat's piss.
If I up the child support, will you buy decent juice?
If you tripled it, Olivia said, sweetly and coldly, glancing at her watch. Not that you could. It might just about cover one carton a week. Kitty has claws, if you keep pulling her tail for long enough. At this point, Holly saved both of us from ourselves by shooting out of her room calling, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!" at the top of her lungs. I made it to the bottom of the stairs in time for her to take a flying leap at me like a little spinning firework, all gold cobweb hair and pink sparkly things, wrapping her legs around my waist and whacking me in the back with her school bag and a fuzzy pony called Clara that had seen better days.
"Hello, spider monkey," I said, kissing the top of her head.
She was light as a fairy. "How was your week?"
"Very busy, and I'm not a spider monkey," she told me severely, nose to nose.
"What's a spider monkey?" Holly is 9, and the fine-boned, easy-bruised spit of her mother's family. Us Mackies are sturdy and thick-skinned and thick-haired, built for hard work in Dublin weather. All except for her eyes. The first time I ever saw her, she looked up at me with my own eyes. Great, wide, bright blue eyes that hit me like a taser zap. And they still make my heart flip over every time. Olivia can scrape off my surname like an out-of-date address label, load up the fridge with juice I don't like, and invite Dermo the pedo to fill my side of the bed. But there's not a thing she can do about those eyes. I told Holly,
It's a magic fairy monkey that lives in an enchanted wood. She gave me a look that was perfectly balanced between wow and nice try. What is you so busy? She slid off me and landed on the floor with a thump. Chloe and Sarah and me are going to have a band. I drew you a picture in school because we made up a dance, and can I have white boots? And Sarah wrote a song and... For a second there, Olivia and I almost smiled at each other, across her head, before Olivia caught herself and checked her watch again. In the drive, we crossed paths with my friend Dermo, who, as I know for a fact because I snagged his plate number the first time he and Olivia went out to dinner, is an impeccably law-abiding guy who has never even parked his Audi on a double yellow, and who can't help looking like he lives life on the verge of a massive belch. "Evening," he said, giving me an electrocuted nod. I think Dermo may be scared of me. "Holly?" "What do you call him?" I asked Holly, when I had fastened her into her booster seat and Olivia, perfect as Grace Kelly, was kissing Dermo's cheek in the doorway. Holly rearranged Clara's mane and shrugged. "Mum says to call him Uncle Dermot."
"And do you?"
"No. Out loud I don't call him anything. In my head I call him Squid Face." She checked in the rear-view mirror to see if I was going to give out about that. Her chin was all ready to turn stubborn. I started to laugh.
"Beautiful," I told her. "That's my girl."
And I did a handbrake turn to make Olivia and Squidface jump. Since Olivia got sense and kicked me out, I live on the Keys, in a massive apartment block built in the 90s by, apparently, David Lynch. The carpets are so deep that I've never heard a footstep, but even at 4 in the morning you can feel the hum of 500 minds buzzing on every side of you, people dreaming, hoping, worrying, planning, thinking. I grew up in a tenement house, so you would think I'd be good with the factory farm lifestyle, but this is different. I don't know these people. I never even see these people. I have no idea how or when they get in and out of the place. For all I know, they never leave, just stay barricaded in their apartments, thinking. Even in my sleep, I've got one ear tuned to that buzz, ready to leap out of bed and defend my territory if I need to. The decor in my personal corner of Twin Peaks is divorcee chic, by which I mean that 4 years on, it still looks like the moving van hasn't arrived yet. The exception is Holly's room, which is loaded with every fluffy pastel object known to man. The day we went looking for furniture together, I'd finally managed to wrestle 1 weekend a month out of Olivia, and I wanted to buy Holly everything on 3 floors of the shopping centre. A part of me had believed I'd never see her again. "What are we doing tomorrow?" she wanted to know, as we headed up the padded corridor. She was trailing Clara on the carpet by one leg. Last I'd looked, she would have screamed bloody murder at the thought of that horse touching the floor. Blink and you miss something. "Remember that kite I got you? Finish all your homework tonight, and if it's not raining, I'll bring it to the Phoenix Park and teach you to fly it. Can Sarah come? We'll ring her mum after dinner." Holly's mate's parents love me. Nothing feels more responsible than having a detective take your kid to the park. "Dinner! Can we get pizza?" "Sure," I said. Olivia lives an additive-free, organic, high-fiber life. If I don't do a little counterbalancing, the kid'll grow up twice as healthy as all her mates, and feel left out. Why not? And then I unlocked the door, and got my first hint that Holly and I weren't getting any pizza tonight. The voicemail light on my phone was going apeshit. 5 missed calls. Work rings me on my mobile. Field agents and confidential informants ring me on my other mobile. The lads know they'll see me in the pub when they see me, and Olivia sends me text messages when she has to. That left family, which meant my kid sister Jackie, seeing as she was the only one I'd talked to in a couple of decades. 5 calls probably meant one of our parents was dying. I told Holly, "Here," and held out my laptop. "You take that to your room and annoy your mates and I am. I'll be with you in a few minutes." Holly, who knows well that she isn't allowed to go online in private till she's 21, gave me a skeptical look. "If you want a cigarette, Daddy," she told me, very maturely, "you can just go out on the balcony. I know you smoke."
I steered her towards her room with a hand on her back.
"Oh, yeah? What makes you think that?"
At any other time, I would have been seriously curious. I've never smoked in front of Holly, and Olivia wouldn't have told her. We made her mind, the two of us. The idea of it containing things we didn't put there still blows me away.
"I just know," Holly said, dumping Clara and her bag on the bed and looking lofty.
"The kid'll make a detective yet."
"And you shouldn't. Sister Mary Therese says it turns all your insides black."
"Sister Mary Therese is dead right. Smart woman." I switched on the laptop and hooked up the broadband line. "There you go. I have to make a phone call. Don't be buying any diamonds on eBay."
Holly asked, "Are you going to ring your girlfriend?"
She looked tiny and way too wise, standing there in her white padded coat that came halfway down her skinny legs, wide eyes trying not to look scared.
"No," I said.
"No, sweetheart. I don't have a girlfriend."
"Swear?"
"I swear. I'm not planning on getting one anytime soon either. In a few years, maybe you can pick one out for me. How's that?"
"I want Mum to be your girlfriend."
"Yeah," I said.
"I know."
I put my hand on her head for a second. Her hair felt like petals. Then I closed her door behind me and went back to the living room to find out who had died. It was Jackie on the voicemail, all right, and she was going like an express train. Bad sign. Jackie breaks for good news.
"You'll never guess what happened. Go on, have a guess."
And floors the pedal for bad. This was Formula One stuff.
"Ah, Jesus, Francis, would you ever pick up your bleeding phone? I need to talk to you. I'm not just ringing you for the laugh, do I ever? Now, before you go getting a fright, it's not Mammy. God forbid. She's grand. A bit shook up, but aren't we all? She was having palpitations there at first, but she had to sit down. And Carmel gave her a drink of brandy, and she's grand now, aren't you, ma'am? Thank God Carmel was there. She does call round most Fridays after the shopping. She rang me and Kevin to come down. Shay said not to be ringing you. What's the point?" he said. "But I told him to feck off for himself. It's only fair. So, if you're at home, would you ever pick up this phone and talk to me? Francis, I swear to God!"
The message space ran out with a beep. Carmel and Kevin and Shay, oh my. It sounded very much like the entire family had descended on my parents' place. My da, it had to be.
"Daddy," Holly yelled from her room, "how many cigarettes do you smoke every day?"
The voicemail lady told me to press buttons. I followed orders.
"Who says I smoke?" "I need to know. 20?
"For a start."
"Maybe."
Jackie again.
"Bleeding machines, I wasn't finished. Come here. I should have said right away it's not Da either. He's the same as ever. No one's dead or hurt or nothing. Or anyway, we're all grand. Kevin's a bit upset, but I think that's because he's worried about how you'll take it. He's awful fond of you, you know. He still is. Now, it might be nothing, Francis. I don't want you losing the head, right? It could all be a joke, someone messing. That's what we thought at first. Although, pretty shite joke if you ask me, excuse my language." "Daddy, how much exercise do you get?"
"What the hell?"
"I'm a secret ballet dancer." "No, seriously, how much?"
"Not enough."
"And sure, none of us have a clue what to be doing with it, and anyway, so would you ever ring me as soon as you get this? Please, Francis, I'll have me mobile in me hand now."
Click. Beep. Voicemail, babe. Looking back, I should have figured it out by that point, or at least I should have got the general idea.
"Daddy, how much fruit and vegetables do you eat?"
"Truckloads."
"You do not."
"Some." The next three messages were more of the same, at half-hour intervals. By the last one, Jackie had reached the point where only small dogs could hear her.
"Daddy!"
"Give me a sec, sweetie." I took my mobile out on the balcony, above the dark river and the greasy orange lights and the running snarl of the traffic jams, and phoned Jackie. She answered on the first ring.
"Francis, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I've been going mental. Where were you?"
She had slowed down to about 80 miles an hour. "Picking up Holly." "What the hell, Jackie?"
background noise. Even after all that time, I knew the quick bite of Shay's voice straight away. One note of my ma caught me right in the throat.
Ah, God, Francis. Would you sit down for me now? Or get yourself a glass of brandy, something like that.
Jackie, if you don't tell me what's going on, I swear I'm going to come over there and strangle you.
Hang on, hold your horses.
A door closing.
Now,
Jackie said, into sudden quiet.
Right. Do you remember? I was telling you a while back. Some fellas after buying up the three houses at the top of the place, to turn into apartments.
Yeah.
He's not doing the apartments after all. Now everyone's after getting all worried about property prices. He's leaving the houses a while and see what happens. So we got the builders in to take out the fireplaces and the mouldings and that, to sell. There's people pay good money for those yokes, did you know that?
Mentlers.
And they started today, on the one up on the corner. Do you remember? The derelict one.
Number 16.
That's the one. They were taking out the fireplaces, and up behind one of them, they found a suitcase.
Dramatic pause. Drugs, guns, cash, Jimmy Hoffa.
Fuck's sake, Jackie, what?
It's Rosie Daly's, Francis. It's her case. All the layers of traffic noise vanished, snapped right off. That orange glow across the sky turned feral and hungry as forest fire, blinding, out of control.
No, I said. It's not. I don't know where the hell you got that, but it's a load of my arse.
Ah, now, Francis.
Concern and sympathy were pouring off her voice. If she'd been there, I think I would have punched her lights out.
Ah, now, Francis, nothing. You and Ma have yourselves worked up into some hysterical frenzy over sweet fuck all, and now you want me to play along. Listen to me, I know you're...
Unless this is all some stunt to get me over there.
Is that it, Jackie? Are you aiming for some big family reconciliation? Because I'm warning you now, this isn't the fucking Hallmark Channel, and that kind of game isn't going to end well. You big gobshite, you!
Jackie snapped.
Get a hold of yourself. What do you think I am? There's a shirt in that case, a purple paisley oak. Carmel recognizes it.
I'd seen it on Rosie 100 times. Knew what the buttons felt like under my fingers.
Yeah, from every girl in this town in the '80s. Carmel would recognize Elvis walking down Grafton Street for a bit of gossip. I thought she had better sense, but apparently... And there's a birth cert wrapped inside it. Rose Bernadette Daly.
Which more or less killed that line of conversation. I found my smokes, leaned my elbows on the railing, and took the longest drag of my life.
Sorry, Jackie said, softer, for biting your head off. Francis?
Yeah.
Are you all right?
Yeah. Listen to me, Jackie. Do the Dailies know?
They're not in.
Nora moved out to Blanchardstown, I think it was, a few years back.
Mr. Daly and Mrs. Daly go over to her on Friday nights to see the Baba. Mammy thinks she has the number somewhere, but...
Have you called the guards?
Only you, sure.
Who else knows about this?
The builders only. A couple of Polish young fellas they are. When they finished up for the day, they went across to number 15 to ask was there anyone they could give the case to. But number 15's students now. So they sent the Polish fellas down to Ma and Da.
And Ma hasn't told the whole road. Are you sure?
The place isn't the same as you remember it. Half of it's students and yuppies these days. He wouldn't even know their names. The Cullens are still here, and the Nolans and some of the Hearns, but Mammy didn't want to say anything to them till she told the Dailies. It wouldn't be right.
Good. Where's the case now?
It's in the front room. Should the builders not have moved it? They had to get on with their work.
It's grand. Don't touch it any more unless you have to. I'll be over as fast as I can. A second of silence. Then,
Francis, I don't want to be thinking anything terrible, God bless us. But does this not mean that Rosie...
We don't know anything yet, I said. Just sit tight, don't talk to anyone, and wait for me. I hung up and took a quick look into the apartment behind me. Holly's door was still shut. I finished my smoke in one more marathon drag, tossed the butt over the railing, lit another,
and rang Olivia. She didn't even say hello. No, Frank, not this time, not a chance. I don't have a choice, Liv. You begged for every weekend. Begged. If you didn't want them, I do want them. This is an emergency. It always is. The squad can survive without you for 2 days, Frank. No matter what you'd like to think, you're not indispensable. To anyone more than a foot away, her voice would have sounded light and chatty, but she was furious. Tinkling cutlery, arch hoots of laughter, something that sounded like, God help us, a fountain. It's not work this time, I said. It's family. It is, of course. Would this have anything to do with the fact that I'm on my fourth date with Dermot? Liv, I would happily do a lot to wreck your fourth date with Dermot, but I'd never give up time with Holly. You know me better than that. A short, suspicious pause. What kind of family emergency? I don't know yet. Jackie rang me in hysterics from my parents' place. I can't work out the details. I need to get over there fast. Another pause. Then Olivia said on a long, tired breath, Right, we're in the coterie. Drop her down. The coterie has a TV-based chef and gets hand-jobbed in a lot of weekend supplements. It badly needs firebombing. Thanks, Olivia. Seriously, I'll pick her up later tonight if I can, or tomorrow morning. I'll ring you. You do that, Olivia said. If you can, of course. And she hung up. I threw my smoke away and went inside to finish pissing off the women in my life. Holly was sitting cross-legged on her bed, with a computer on her lap and a worried look on her face. Sweetheart, I said, we've got a problem. She pointed at the laptop. Daddy, look! The screen said in big purple letters, surrounded by an awful lot of flashing graphics, You will die at the age of 52. The kid looked really upset. I sat down on the bed behind her and pulled her and the computer onto my lap. What's all this? Sarah found this quiz online, and I did it for you, and it said this. You're 41. Oh, Jesus, not now. Chickadee, it's the internet. Anyone can put anything on there. It doesn't make it real. It says. They figured it all out. Olivia was going to love me if I gave Holly back in tears. Let me show you something, I said. I reached around her, got rid of my death sentence, opened up a Word document and typed in, You are a space alien. You are reading this on the planet Bongo. Now, is that true? Holly managed a watery giggle. Course not. I turned it purple and gave it a fancy font. How about now? Headshake. How about if I got the computer to ask you a bunch of questions before it said that? Would it be true then? For a second, I thought I'd got through. But then those narrow shoulders went rigid. You said a problem. Yeah, we're going to have to change our plans just a little bit. I have to go back to Mum's, Holly said to the laptop. Don't I? Yep, sweetie. I'm really, really sorry. I'll come and get you the second I can. Does work need you again? That again felt worse than anything Olivia could dish out. No, I said, leaning sideways so I could see Holly's face. It's nothing to do with work. Work can take a long walk off a short pier, am I right? That got a faint smile. You know your Aunt Jackie? She's got a big problem, and she needs me to sort it out for her right now. Can't I come with you? Both Jackie and Olivia have tried hinting occasionally that Holly should get to know her dad's family. Sinister suitcases aside, over my dead body does Holly dip a toe in the bubbling cauldron of crazy that is the Mackies at their finest. Not this time. Once I've fixed everything, we'll bring Aunt Jackie for an ice cream somewhere, will we? To cheer us all up. Yeah, Holly said, in a tired little breath exactly like Olivia's. That'd be fun. And she disentangled herself from my lap and started putting her stuff back into her school bag. In the car, Holly kept up a running conversation with Clara in a subdued little voice too quiet for me to hear. At every red light I looked at her in the rearview mirror, and swore to myself that I'd make it up to her. Get hold of the Daly's phone number, dump the damn suitcase on their doorstep, and have Holly back at El Rancho Lincho by bedtime. I already knew it wasn't going to work out that way. That road, and that suitcase, had been waiting for me to come back for a long time. Now that they'd got their hooks in, what they had saved up for me was going to take a lot more than one evening. The note had the bare minimum of teen queen melodrama. She was always good that way, was Rosie. I know this is going to be a shock, and I'm sorry, but please don't be feeling like I messed you around on purpose. I never wanted to do that. Only, I've thought about it really hard. This is the only way I'll ever have a decent chance at the kind of life I want. I just wish I could do it and not hurt you, upset you, disappoint you. It would be great if you could wish me luck in my new life in England. But if you can't, I understand. I swear I'll come back someday. Till then, loads and loads and loads of love. Rosie. In between the moment when she left that note on the floor of number 16, in the room where we had our first kiss, and the moment when she went to heave her suitcase over some wall and get the hell out of Dodge, something had happened. Chapter 2. You won't find Faithful Place unless you know where to look. The Liberties grew on their own over centuries, without any help from urban planners, and the place is a cramped cul-de-sac tucked away in the middle like a wrong turn in a maze. It's a 10-minute walk from Trinity College and the snazzy shopping on Grafton Street, but back in my day, we didn't go to Trinity, and the Trinity types didn't come up our way. The area wasn't dodgy, exactly. Factory workers, bricklayers, bakers, doll bunnies, and the odd lucky bastard who worked in Guinness's and got health care and evening classes. Just separate. The Liberties got their name hundreds of years ago because they went their own way and made their own rules. The rules in my road went like this. No matter how skint you are, if you go to the pub, then you stand your round. If your mate gets into a fight, you stick around to drag him off as soon as you see blood, so no one loses face. You leave the heroin to them down in the flats. Even if you're an anarchist punk rocker this month, you go to Mass on Sunday, and no matter what, you never, ever squeal on anyone. I parked my car a few minutes away and walked. No reason to let my family know what I drove, or that I had a booster seat in the back. Night air in the Liberties still felt the same, warm and restless, crisp packets and bus tickets whirling in updrafts, a rowdy hum spilling out from the pubs. The junkies hanging on the corner had started wearing bling with their tracksuits for your truly suave fashion statement. Two of them eyed me up and started drifting my way, but I gave them a big shark smile, and they changed their minds. Faithful Place is two rows of eight houses, old red bricks with steps going up to the main hall door. Back in the 80s, each one had three or four households, maybe more. A household was anything from mad Johnny Malone, who'd been in World War I and would show you his Ypres tattoo, through Sally Hearn, who wasn't exactly a hooker, but had to support all those kids somehow. If you were on the dole, you got a basement flat and a vitamin D deficiency. If someone had a job, you got at least part of the first floor. If your family had been there a few generations, you got seniority and top-floor rooms where no one walked on your head. Places are supposed to look smaller when you go back to them, but my road just looked schizoid. A couple of the houses had had nifty little makeovers involving double glazing and an amusing faux antique pastel paint. Most of them hadn't. Number 16 looked like it was on its last legs. The roof was in tatters. There was a pile of bricks and a dead wheelbarrow by the front steps. And at some point in the last 20 years, someone had set the door on fire. In number 8, a window on the first floor was lit up, gold and cosy, and dangerous as hell. Carmel and Shay and I came along straight after my parents got married, one a year,
just like you'd expect in the land of the contraband condom. Kevin was almost 5 years later, once my parents got their breath back, and Jackie was 5 years after that, presumably in one of the brief moments when they didn't hate each other's guts. We had the first floor of number 8, 4 rooms, girls' room, boys' room, kitchen, front room. The toilet was in a shed down the back of the garden, and you washed in a tin bath in the kitchen. These days, Ma and Da have all that space to themselves. I see Jackie every few weeks, and she keeps me up to speed, depending on your definition of the term. She feels I need to know every detail of everyone's life, while I feel I need to know if someone dies, so it took us a while to find that happy medium. When I walked back into Faithful Place, I knew that Carmel had 4 kids, and an arse like the 77A bus. Shay was living upstairs from my parents and working in the same bike shop you left school for. Kevin was selling flat-screen TVs and had a new girlfriend every month. Da had done something unclear to his back, and Ma was still Ma. Jackie, to round out the picture, is a hairdresser and lives with this guy Gavin, who she says she might marry someday. If she had been following orders, which I doubted, the others knew sweet fuck all about me. The hall door was unlocked. So was the flat door. No one leaves doors open in Dublin anymore. Jackie, tactfully, had arranged things so I could make my entrance my own way. There were voices coming from the front room. Short sentences, long pauses. "How is?" I said, in the doorway. A ripple of cups going down, heads turning. My ma's snappy black eyes and 5 bright blue pairs exactly like mine, all staring at me. "Hide the heroin," Shay said. He was leaning against the window with his hands in his pockets. He'd watched me coming down the road. "It's the pigs." The landlord had finally put in a carpet, a flowery green and pink thing. The room still smelled of toast, damp and furniture polish, with a faint, dirty undercurrent I couldn't place. There was a tray full of doilies and digestive biscuits on the table. My Da and Kevin were in the armchairs. My Ma was on the sofa, with Carmel and Jackie on either side, like a war leader showing off 2 prize prisoners. "My Ma is your classic Dublin mammy. 5 foot nothing of curler-haired, barrel-shaped, don't mess with this, fueled by an endless supply of disapproval." The prodigal son's welcome went like this. "Francis," Ma said. She eased back into the sofa, folded her arms where her waist would have been, and eyed me up and down. "Could you not be bothered putting on a decent shirt, even?" I said, "How are you, Ma?" "Mammy, not Ma. The state of you. The neighbours'll think I raised a homeless." Somewhere along the way, I swapped the army parka for a brown leather jacket, but apart from that I still have much the same fashion sense I left home with. If I'd worn a suit, she would have given me hassle for having notions about myself. With my Ma, you don't expect to win. "Jackie sounded like it was urgent," I said. "How are you, Da?" Da was looking better than I expected. Back in the day, I was the one who took after him. Same thick brown hair, same rough-edged features. But the resemblance had faded a lot along the way, which was nice. He was starting to turn into an old fella, white hair, trousers up above his ankles. But he still had enough muscle that you'd think twice before taking him on. He looked stone-cold sober, although with him you never could tell till it was too late.
"Nice of you to honour us," he said.
His voice was deeper and hoarser. Too many camels.
"You've still got a neck like a jockey's bollocks."
"So they keep telling me. How are you, Carmel? Kev? Shay?" Shay didn't bother to answer. "Francis," Kevin said. He was staring at me like I was a ghost. He'd turned into a big guy, fair and solid and good-looking, bigger than me.
"Jesus!" "Language," Ma snapped. You're looking very well,
Carmel informed me, predictably. If the risen Lord appeared to Carmel one morning, she'd tell him he was looking very well. Her arse was, in fact, pretty high impact, and she had developed a genteel meet-my-sinuses accent that didn't surprise me one bit. Things around here were more like they used to be than they had ever been. Thanks very much, I said. So are you. Come here, you, Jackie said to me. Jackie has complicated peroxide hair, and she dresses like something out of a Tom Waits diner. That day she was wearing white pedal pushers and a red polka-dot top with ruffles in bewildering places. Sit down there and have a cup of tea. I'll get another cup. She got up and headed for the kitchen, giving me an encouraging little wink and a pinch on her way. I'm grand, I said, stopping her. The thought of sitting next to Ma made the hair go up on the back of my neck. Let's have a look at this famous suitcase. Where's your rush? Ma demanded. Sit down there. Business before pleasure. Where's the case? Shay nodded to the floor at his feet. All yours, he said. Jackie sat down again with a thump. I picked my way around the coffee table and the sofa and the chairs, under all those eyes. The suitcase was by the window. It was a pale blue thing, with rounded corners, spotted over with big patches of black mould, and it was a crack open. Someone had forced the pathetic tin locks. What got to me was how small it was. Olivia used to pack her just about everything we owned, including the electric kettle, for a weekend away. Rosie had been heading for a whole new life with something she could carry one-handed. I asked, "Who's touched this?" Shay laughed, a hard sound at the back of his throat. "Jesus, lads, it's Columbo. Are you gonna take our fingerprints?" Shay is dark and wiry and restless, and I'd forgotten what it was like getting too near him. It's like standing next to a power line that makes you edgy all over. He had sharp, fierce grooves going from nose to mouth these days, and between his eyebrows. "Only if you ask me nicely," I said. "Did you all touch it?" "I wouldn't go near it," Carmel said promptly, doing a little shudder. "The dirt of it." I caught Kevin's eye. For a second, it was like I'd never been away. "Me and your dad tried opening it," Ma said, "only it was locked. So I called Shay down and I got him to take a screwdriver to it. We'd no choice, sure. There was nothing on the outside to tell us who owned it." She gave me a belligerent look. "Dead right," I said. "When we saw what was in it, I'm telling you, I got the shock of my life. The heart was leaping out of me. I thought I was having a heart attack. I said to Carmel, 'Thank God you're here with the car in case you have to bring me to the hospital.'" The look in Ma's eye said this would have been my fault, even if she hadn't figured out how yet. Carmel told me, "Trevor doesn't mind giving the children their tea, not when it's an emergency. He's great that way." "Me and Kevin both had a look inside once we got here," Jackie said. "We touched bits. I don't remember what ones."
"Got your fingerprint powder?" Shay inquired. He was slouching against the window frame and watching me, eyes half closed.
"Some other day, if you're a good boy."
I found my surgical gloves in my jacket pocket and put them on.
Da started to laugh, a deep, nasty rasp. It collapsed into a helpless coughing fit that shook his whole chair.
Shay's screwdriver was on the floor beside the suitcase. I knelt down and used it to lift the lid. Two of the boys in the tech bureau owed me favours, and a couple of the lovely ladies fancied me. Any of them would run a few tests for me on the QT, but they would appreciate me not fucking up the evidence any more than I had to. The case was stuffed with a heavy tangle of fabric, stained black and half-shredded with mould and age. A dark, strong smell like wet earth came up off it. That undercurrent I'd caught in the air when I first came in. I lifted things out slowly, one by one, and stacked them in the lid where they wouldn't get contaminated. One pair of baggy blue jeans, with plaid patches sewn under the rips and the knees.
one green woolen pullover, one pair of blue jeans so tight they had zips at the ankles, and Jesus almighty, I knew them. The swing of Rosie's hips in them punched me right in the gut. I kept moving, and didn't blink. One man's collarless flannel shirt, fine blue stripes on what used to be cream. Six pairs of white cotton knickers. One long-tailed purple and blue paisley shirt falling to pieces. And when I picked it up, the birth cert fell out. "There," Jackie said. She was leaning over the arm of the sofa, peering anxiously at me. "See? Up until then we thought it might have been nothing. I don't know. Kids messing, or someone who'd robbed some gear and needed to hide it. Or maybe some poor woman whose fella was hurting her, and she was keeping her things ready for when she got the courage to leave him. You know how they tell you to do in the magazines." She was starting to rev up again. Rose Bernadette Daly, born 30th of July, 1966. The paper was on the verge of disintegrating. "Yep," I said. "If that's kids messing, they're pretty thorough about it." One U2 t-shirt, probably worth hundreds, if it hadn't been pockmarked with rot. One blue and white striped t-shirt. One man's black waistcoat. The Annie Hall look was in then. One purple woolen pullover. One pale blue plastic rosary. Two white cotton bras. One off-brand Walkman that I had spent months saving for. I got the last £2 a week before her 18th birthday by helping Beaker Murray sell bootleg videos down at the Ivy Market. One spray can of Sure deodorant. A dozen home-taped cassettes. And I could still read her round handwriting on some of the inserts. R.E.M., Murmur, U2, Boy, Thin Lizzy, The Boomtown Rats, The Stranglers, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Rosie could leave everything else behind, but her record collection was coming with her. At the bottom of the case was a brown envelope. The bits of paper inside had been mashed into a solid lump by 22 years' worth of damp. When I pulled delicately at the edge, it came apart like wet jack's roll. One more favour for the Bureau. A few blurred words of type still showed through the plastic window in the front of the envelope. Leary Holly Head, departing, 30 a.m. Wherever Rosie had gone, she had got there without our ferry tickets. Everyone was staring at me. Kevin looked genuinely upset. "Well," I said, "that appears to be Rosie Daly's suitcase, all right." I started to transfer stuff from the lid back into the case, leaving the papers to last so they wouldn't get crushed. "When we called the guards," Carmel asked. Da cleared his throat spectacularly, like he was going to spit. Ma shot him a ferocious look. I asked, "And say what?" Clearly, no one had thought about this. "Someone stuck a suitcase behind a fireplace 20-odd years ago," I said. "It's hardly the crime of the century. The Dailies can ring the guards if they want, but I'm warning you now, I wouldn't expect them to bring out the big guns for the case of the block chimney." "But Rosie, sure," Jackie said. She was tugging at a piece of hair and gazing at me, all bunny teeth and big, worried blue eyes. "She's missing. And that yoke there, that's a clue, or evidence, or whatever you call it. Should we not?" "Was she reported missing?" Glances back and forth. Nobody knew. I seriously doubted it. In the Liberties, cops are like the jellyfish in Pac-Man. They're part of the game, you get good at avoiding them, and you definitely don't go looking for them. "If she wasn't," I said, shutting the case with my fingertips, "it's a little late now."
"But," Jackie said, "hang on. Does this not look like, you know, like she didn't go off to England after all? Does it not seem like maybe someone might have..."
"What Jackie's trying to say here," Shay told me, "is it looks like someone knocked Rosie off, shoved her in a bin liner, hauled her around to the piggeries, dumped her in, and put that case up a fireplace to get it out of the way."
"Seamus, Mackie, God bless us,"
from Ma. Carmel crossed herself.
This possibility had already occurred to me.
"Could be," I said,
Sure. Or she could have been abducted by aliens and dropped off in Kentucky by mistake. Personally, I'd go for the simplest explanation, which is that she stuck that case up the chimney herself, didn't get a chance to take it back out, and headed over to England without a change of undies. But if you need a little extra drama in your life, feel free.
Right, said Shay.
There are plenty of things wrong with Shay, but stupid isn't one of them.
And that's why you need that shite.
The gloves, which I was stuffing back into my jacket.
Because you don't think there's any crime here.
Reflex, I said, grinning at him. A pig is a pig, 24/7, know what I mean?
Shay made a disgusted noise.
Ma said, with a nice blend of awe, envy, and bloodlust, Teresa Daly'll go mental. Mental.
For a wide variety of reasons, I needed to get to the Daly's before anyone else did.
I'll have a chat with her and Mr. Daly, see what they want to do. What time do they get home, Saturdays?
Shay shrugged. Depends. Sometimes not till after lunch, sometimes first thing in the morning, whenever Nora can drop them back.
This was a pisser. I could tell by the look of Ma that she was already planning to pounce on them before they got their key in the door. I considered sleeping in my car and cutting her off at the pass, but there was no parking within surveillance range. Shay was watching me and enjoying himself. Then Ma hitched up her bosom and said, You can stay the night here, Francis, if you like. The sofa still pulls out. I didn't assume this was a reunion burst of the warm and fuzzies. My Ma likes you to owe her. This is never a good idea, but I couldn't come up with a better one. She added, Unless you're too posh for that nowadays, in case I thought she was going soft.
Not at all, I said, giving Shay a big, toothy grin.
That'd be great. Thanks, Ma. Mammy, not Ma. I suppose you'll be wanting breakfast and all.
Can I stay as well?
Kevin asked, out of the blue. Ma gave him a suspicious stare. He looked as startled as I was.
I can't stop you, she said in the end. Don't be wrecking my good sheets.
And she hoisted herself up off the sofa and started collecting teacups. Shay laughed, not nicely.
Peace on Walton's Mountain, he said, nudging the suitcase with the toe of his boot. Just in time for Christmas.
Ma doesn't allow smoking in the house. Shay and Jackie and I took our habit outside. Kevin and Carmel drifted after us. We sat on the front steps, the way we used to when we were kids, sucking ice pops after tea, and waiting for something interesting to happen. It took me a little while to realize that I was still waiting for the action. Kids with a football, a couple yelling, a woman hurrying across the road to swap gossip for tea bags, anything, and that it wasn't coming. In number 11, a couple of hairy students were cooking something and playing keen, not even that loudly. And in number 7, Sally Hearn was ironing and someone was watching TV. This was apparently as active as the place got these days. We'd gravitated straight to our old spots, Shay and Carmel at opposite ends of the top step, Kevin and me below them, Jackie at the bottom between us. We had personal arse prints worn in those steps.
Jesus, it's warm all the same, Carmel said. It's not like December at all, sure it's not. Feels all wrong.
Global warming, Kevin said. Someone, give us a smoke.
Jackie handed up her packet.
Don't be starting on them. Filthy habit. Only on special occasions.
I flicked my lighter, and he leaned across to me. The flame sent the shadows of his lashes down his cheeks, so that for a second he looked like a kid asleep, rosy and innocent. Kevin worshipped me back in the day, followed me everywhere. I gave Zippy Hearn a bloody nose because he took Kevin's jelly tots off him. Now he smelled of aftershave.
Sally, I said, nodding up at her, how many kids did she have in the end?
Jackie reached a hand over her shoulder to take her smokes back off Kevin.
14. Me fanny's sore just thinking about it.
I snickered, caught Kevin's eye and got a grin off him.
After a moment, Carmel said to me, I've four of my own. Darren and Louise and Donna and Ashley. Jackie told me. Fair play to you.